Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. Anxiety was already on the rise in the U.S., and then the pandemic made matters worse with all the worry, stress, and isolation. If you're an anxious person, there are usually signature symptoms.
Very bad chest pains that prevent me from completing tasks. The feeling that my skin is buzzing.
Rapid heartbeat. I lose my breath and I get a lot of nausea.
I'm overanalyzing everything around me. And on top of that, sometimes I get jittery.
My legs and my hands and fingers are constantly fidgeting.
My chest constricts, almost like someone's giving me a hug, but it feels kind of claustrophobic.
Get tunnel vision, get dizzy, feel like I'm going to die. even when I know I'm technically that I'm totally fine.
Anxiety is also sneaky and can express itself in so many unexpected ways. Like when I'm feeling anxious about some kind of illness or threat, I obsessively research things. I'll try to calculate my odds. I start cleaning or organizing things. Some people bake, make detailed schedules and to-do lists, or avoid places and tasks without even really realizing it. I think during the pandemic, the toilet paper hoarding and the way people stocked up on groceries, it was all anxiety. Anxiety can feel like a buzzing electric current that fuels thoughts and behaviors. Checking your phone obsessively to see if your kid got to school okay, jumping out of your seat at the slightest noise, or going from doctor to doctor to find an explanation for some weird medical symptom. On today's show, how anxiety impacts our behavior and what we can do about it. First up, working from home has been exhausting for lots of people, feeling isolated and stressed, like there's no distinction between the office and home. We've heard that story over and over, but there's another, quieter story. The story of those who found unexpected relief working from home. Relief from something they hadn't even realized was draining them. Reporter Jad Slayman has more. And just a note, the people he talked to for this story didn't want to use their last names, since it seems like returning to the office is a hot-button topic in a lot of workplaces right now.
It was the little things that were the most horrible for me. Pre-pandemic, I'm in this oppressively long hallway we have back at the office, walk into the bathroom, and then there they are, a person I kind of know, way at the other end, and they're walking in my direction. They've seen me, and they know I've seen them, but neither of us acknowledge this. Instead, it begins, the countdown as the gap between us closes, the question asked and asked again with every step closer. At what distance will it not be weird to wave or nod or say what's up? Is it weird that I'm pretending not to see them until that moment? I can't just yell hello from 40 feet away. If I wave, maybe they won't see it and then I'll have been left hanging. Whoa, just look at the old phone for a bit. Sup, bro? Hey, dude. Another successful human acquaintance interaction. Some listeners are probably scratching their heads at this, like, okay, what's the big deal? But some of you, you know what I'm talking about. It's people dealing with people.
I like people, right?
That's one of us, Amy. She works in media.
I just don't like all the work it takes to be around people. So I hope I'll be able to continue to create a balance.
Amy describes herself as an introvert who has learned to be extroverted, a skill she knows how to use, but has to work at. For her, the pandemic was a break from the little bits of social interaction we never realized were so subtly stressful.
Did I say something weird at lunch? And, you know, oh my God, does that person just not like me? Or did I've worked here for 2 years and they didn't acknowledge me today? Does that mean they didn't? Whatever it is, it's the social anxiety part of work. I don't think any of us realized how much we were squeezing out of our mental sort of sponge until we're home and get to feel it.
This constant anxious churn over stuff that doesn't matter, Amy didn't notice how much of a toll it was taking on her until it was gone, until she no longer had to wear what she calls these masks.
There are a lot of these social masks that we wear in the office, whether it's code switching or clothes we wear or makeup or how we present ourselves that you don't have to do in the privacy of your own home.
Amy wasn't really herself at work.
In an office, I'm loud, I'm aggressive, I'm noisy, I'm annoying as shit. And I recognize now how much of that is related to anxiety.
Just talking to fill up dead air, a performance for people who may or may not actually be watching. In the office, it can feel like eyes are always on you, especially in an open office.
Oh my goodness, it makes it worse because there's nowhere to hide.
Amy remembers the strange relief she got when an office manager added a beautiful, merciful, extra wall to her cubicle. Now, people could only see her from one direction.
Do you know how much it helped me to have that little second wall there? And so I had a little cubby and I felt like I could hide out.
Everything Amy's saying speaks to me, and probably to some of you. When we went to work from home, we were suddenly no longer spending all this energy just being in some place with others for hours every day.
It just seemed like there were just too many channels of communication that I had to manage, and then that would just become very exhausting for me.
That's Karen. She works in finance. People in the office weren't just a source of stress. To her, they were work.
I think I'm a weird, I think the term is an ambivert probably, where I can find social interactions to be very exhausting.
The social interactions in the office added up, and they tapped out what Karen called her social energy meter. By the time she got home, she felt like she had nothing left. That changed this past year.
I've kind of socialized more with, you know, the people in my neighborhood or with my family, or made more of an effort to be in touch with my friends, you know, on a deeper level, because I wasn't, you know, like I said, my social energy meter can tap out. So if I'm spending all of that energy with the people I work with, then it leaves less of that for the people I live near and care deeply about.
I talked about all this with Jyoti Samra, a Canadian clinical psychologist who specializes in mental health issues in the workplace.
Let's talk about anxiety specifically, because one of the most marked areas of increase that we have seen since the pandemic hit has been a massive uptick in anxiety. And in fact, some of our stats will tell us that anxiety rates have quadrupled collectively. Now, what that misses is the fact that there are certain individuals and subgroups that have actually found counterintuitively the opposite, where anxiety has gone down.
She's seen them trickle into her practice, these lucky few, all of them surprised to be feeling better.
It has been actually quite stunning and unexpected initially to see, you know, people coming in and saying, my anxiety's actually reduced, being at home has, you know, I'm embracing it.
Could some people find relief from their anxiety simply by working from home instead of an office?
You know, do I see that as a standalone prescription? Probably not, because I'd say for most people, it's not as simple as just the work environment.
It can help, she says, but it's a bit of a chicken and egg thing. Like, is your work making you anxious, or were you anxious before you walked in, and so now work feels like the cause? Jyoti thinks it's a bit of both. You don't leave your psychology at the door when you walk into work, and you don't leave your work at work when you go home. But she does think that we need to think more carefully before pathologizing a normal human reaction to the absurdities of an open office floor plan where everyone hears everyone's conversations, like it or not, and your coworkers know how often you go to the bathroom.
We're creatures of habit, and we kind of get used to things the way that they are. And so what that means is, you know, whether it's high multiple stressors, whether it's things that are in the background that might be negatively contributing to mood, what happens is we kind of just get used to it the way that it is.
That was true for me and Amy, the media worker grateful for the extra cubicle wall. She talks about the exhaustion of what she calls the daily public performance at an office.
By the time you get home, it's like, ugh. And there are people who do it every day for years and decades. And, you know, so a lot of it for me was just saying, everybody does this, just suck it up. You have to drive an hour, you get to your job, you do your job, you go home. And it stinks. And everybody, it stinks for everybody, not just you.
Amy hasn't had to deal with that for months. She makes more time for herself and for her family. More of her energy goes to that instead of to the little stressors of office life. Jody tells me most people she's heard from don't want total work from home, though. More some kind of balance, a middle ground where you go in here and there. Amy, amid her at-home bliss, told me about the same thing.
So I hope I'll be able to continue to create a balance. But if left to my own devices, I will self-isolate, and then that's not healthy either. So it's good to be pushed a little bit.
For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.
We're talking about the undercurrent of anxiety that can fuel so many behaviors and emotions. During the pandemic, we've all had to face a lot of uncertainty. Our day-to-day routines were disrupted, those carefully laid plans postponed indefinitely, and just not knowing what might happen next.
Uncertainty is uncomfortable. I mean, that idea that your knowledge has fallen short is not a good feeling, because humans are also innately driven to need answers and to have answers for survival's sake.
That's Maggie Jackson. She is a journalist and author. She writes about social trends and the impact of technology on people's lives. She's researching uncertainty for a new book. If you really think about it, many aspects of our lives are uncertain every day. Will I get home safely? Is my passport going to arrive in time for my trip? Is my job stable? Did I miss the delivery guy again? It's a huge list of big and small things. Sometimes the uncertainty bothers us. Sometimes we don't even think about it. But things have been different during the pandemic. The uncertainty felt almost like this undercurrent of anxiety, of just this always present low-level discomfort.
Or sometimes very high-level discomfort.
Yeah.
Had to go to the grocery store or wherever you had to be. Uncertainty is also highly related to anxiety. And this is these are some really new discoveries in psychological and neuroscience. Fear of uncertainty, discomfort with uncertainty, is seen as the foundation for anxiety. So it used to be that people would treat anxiety by treating specific phobias or fears, you know, your fear of getting on that airplane, your fear of the party. But when it comes to sort of a generalized anxiety, that is just worrying about almost anything, worrying throughout our lives, which is sort of syncs with the pandemic lifestyle, the pandemic mentality, that's seen as being driven by a fear of the unknown. And you can't get the answer all the time in life, of course. You know, we are constantly dealing with uncertainties, big and small. But when questions ratchet up and there really aren't answers, even on the part of experts, and that's where intolerance of uncertainty, as they call it, fits in. I would like my jaw to, you know, get relaxed for the first time in a year and a half, frankly. intolerance of uncertainty is your approach to, your attitude toward it.
Maggie says we can reframe our relationship with uncertainty, approach it with an open mind, see a situation as a challenge, not a threat.
basically confront the uncertainty in our lives, ratchet back the negative and the fear, the emotional part of dealing with uncertainty. And then suddenly the world becomes a more open place.
And I guess we have to recognize that certainty is an illusion in many, many instances.
Exactly. We can have foundational beliefs in the good of family or the need for truth, but at the same time, utter certainty really is a mirage. And that's kind of a tricky concept to deal with for anyone. I mean, we really do need our habits and our routines and our beliefs and our foundations. And I think one of the things I've learned is that humans are never going to have trouble finding those. It's the pushing ourselves out to explore from the safety of the knowledge that we know. But the other part of uncertainty is it really does have something to do with humility. Because if you're willing to not be quite as afraid of uncertainty, well, then you suddenly become a little more capable of wonder, awe, and curiosity. You begin to know that you don't always know. You come out from under the umbrella of that sureness.
And I would think if we come back to anxiety, it sounds like if you embrace this uncertainty and look at it with curiosity, maybe even as an opportunity, I could see that easing your anxiety.
Well, precisely, because you just don't have to worry as much all the time. You know, you might just think of something that you worried about as a little adventure rather than something that needs to be mapped out and planned and prepared for and worried about. So I think it eases the discomfort, the emotional discomfort that comes hand in hand with anxiety, the tension, and then it eases the time and effort that we all spend trying to control or avoid uncertainty through our worries.
Maggie Jackson is a tech and social critic. She's writing a book about uncertainty and its role in our lives. Coming up, I attempt to better understand my over-the-top startle response and to do something about it.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, my God. Whew.
That's next on The Pulse.
Ah, ah.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com. The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about anxiety and how it affects emotions and behavior. My mother often told me when I was a baby and people bent over my crib, I threw up my arms in terror, looking aghast. My startle response has not changed much since. Anything will startle me. A noise, a mouse, a leaf, somebody speaking to me when I'm in deep thought. I gasp, sometimes I curse, my body jerks back, my heart starts pounding, and in really serious cases, I get such a quick adrenaline rush, my fingers tingle. I'm acting like I'm terrified by life. It annoys me, and it's often embarrassing. I posted about this on Twitter, complaining about being startled by a phantom mouse, and I wondered if I could take control of this somehow. I heard from so many people who could relate, like Barbara.
I will jump up and say, whoa, 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 what?
Or Georgette, she went to see a movie with her husband and the opening scene had a car crash in it.
I was so startled that I practically jumped out of my seat and my arms went flailing, knocking the sweetened iced tea out of my cup holder and not onto me, but onto my dear husband, his shirt, his face, his pants. So poor guy, he had to sit through the rest of the movie with this sweetened, sticky liquid all over him.
Or Eugene and his wife, Jess. He tries very hard not to startle her.
I feel like sometimes I will anticipate it and think, oh, let me knock on the door or the doorway if the door is open. But even the knock on the door will send you to... Ah!
I don't know. I have to laugh at it myself because I know there are times when you can be standing somewhere and I know you're there and still somehow I can jump a foot into the air because I'm startled by the presence of you. So it's like a continuous surprise.
That's how I feel, continuously surprised and shocked by not very shocking things. Like, I have children, and there will be loud noises in my house. My phone will ring, and coworkers will talk to me. I wanted to understand this reaction better and find out if there was anything I could do about it. I reached out to Seth Norholm. He teaches psychiatry at Wayne State University School of Medicine in Detroit. And he studies people's startle response in experiments that sound like a nightmare to me.
I'd present about 108 decibel noise for 40 milliseconds, so a brief fraction of a second. And that's about as loud as if you were standing next to a train track and a train went by. That's about 108 decibels.
Seth measures how much participants blink to get their baseline startle response. But there's more.
If I then shut off all the lights in the studio and presented that same exact tone again, most likely your startle response is going to be greater. And so we call that dark enhanced startle. And the reason your startle is enhanced in the dark is because we as human beings do not do very well in the dark.
In the dark, a sudden loud noise will make you feel even more on edge, and the startle response increases. Do people come back to your lab or?
Yes, I'm
wondering.
I can safely report that over the 15 years or so that we've been doing this, we've startled thousands of people, and many of those on multiple occasions.
Some people seem to startle more easily. Their response is stronger, and I'm certainly one of them. So I startle quickly. I startle at everything. What is that about? What does that relate to?
Yeah, I did see your tweet about whether or not you can control your startle response. So the quick answer to that is no. You're going to startle and then realize you startled. So you don't have a whole lot of, executive control over it.
Seth told me startling is part of the fight, flight, or freeze response.
It's a reflex in the sense that it actually happens below the level of consciousness at the level of your spinal cord. So typically you hear a loud noise, you'll blink your eyes in response, then you'll recognize that you heard a noise and then recognize that you blinked. It happens without your conscious knowledge of it. So it's an adaptive response as part of our autonomic nervous system, and it's a way to prepare ourselves for an imminent threat.
So if I hear a loud noise, I'm likely to go something like, and I'll jump, like I'll probably raise up my hand and my shoulders will move.
Right.
What is that supposed to do for me?
In human beings, the most common startle response is to blink your eyes. But if the sound is loud enough, then you're not only going to blink your eyes, but you're also going to tuck your head in and perhaps raise your arms to protect your head. And so this is a defensive orienting move meant to protect the vital organs and the brain within the skull.
A loud bang, a box falling right behind you can set off a cascade through your autonomic nervous system.
And it's going to initiate a stress response. There's going to be signals sent from a part of your brain called the hypothalamus to the pituitary gland, and the pituitary gland is then going to release its own set of hormones that are going to lead to the release of cortisol, which is the human stress hormone. And that cortisol is going to, you know, course through your bloodstream to prepare you for this threatening situation. And so that's when, as a downstream effect, you'll see perhaps pulse rate will increase and breathing rate will change.
Seth says we're born with different baseline levels of how much we startle.
So just like you have blue eyes and brown hair, you have a trait level of startle that you're born with. So you remember as a kid when a balloon popped, you know, you had a pretty robust response. And now as an adult, when boxes fall or doors slam, you notice you have a robust response as well.
But there are things that impact our response. For example, your emotional state. Let's say Seth has measured somebody's baseline startle response with that sudden loud noise.
And then I start to show them images of a growling dog or a house on fire or an individual pointing a gun at them, and then present that same noise, they're going to startle much more. But on the flip side, if I start to show a lot of positive images, you know, two people walking on a beach, flowers, you know, landscapes, you actually see a reduction in startle.
Is there a tie between startle reflex and anxiety, how anxious a person is?
There's a relationship between startle and anxiety. One is if somebody by demeanor is an anxious person, a nervous Nelly, a worrywart, whatever, you know, phrase you want to use, they may have an elevated startle response as part of that personality profile. But let's say somebody has specific fears or anxieties. So it's somebody who is a spider phobic or arachnophobic, or somebody who is afraid of flying. Their startle reflex during most of their life may be quote unquote normal, you know, pretty responsive, but not anything extreme. But if you put them in the presence of a situation or a cue that they're afraid of, then they're going to startle much more.
That also happens after traumatic experiences. People with post-traumatic stress often startle easily. For example, if somebody's been in a car accident, they may have heightened startle responses in traffic afterwards. In terms of calming one's own startle reflex, you've explained that you have very little control over it, but it does seem like if I were overall less stressed out and calmer, then perhaps my startle reflex would go down as well.
Yes, if you feel like you're anxious, the way we talk about that clinically is more of the time than not, then it could be that your enhanced startle is because you're in a constant state of anxiety. So in that case, yes, if you had better sleep, if you started to do meditation and yoga, those would all bring down that excessive rate of startle or level of startle. But if you tell me that you have a high startle response to, let's say, you know, your coworkers are constantly slamming the door and you're having a strong reaction to it, you can set up in a situation, and this is what we call extinction learning, which is another way of saying exposure therapy. If it was the case that you startled to that slamming door all the time, you could have, let's say, a helpful coworker slam the door repeatedly so that you get habituated and used to that noise, and that will bring down your startle response. So you can either bring down overall levels of stress and anxiety, or you can bring down the response to a specific startling cue that you've identified.
Oh, so it would be, I'm thinking about, I don't know if you ever watched the Pink Panther movies with the inspector who always gets attacked by his servant.
Yes.
And he just doesn't even react to it anymore because it's just like, it's what they do, and he has accustomed himself to that, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what we're talking about. You know, when I started doing this several years ago, you know, I would test the equipment on myself and see my startle response come up on the computer screen. But now when I, you know, set up these systems, I hardly even notice the sound in the headphones, and I, you know, have to have somebody else listen to it because it just doesn't sound that loud to me anymore.
Hearing this, I wondered if I could maybe try to desensitize myself to loud noises and startle less. So I decided to give it a shot. I started by looking around online for some loud noises.
Loud noise. Extremely painful sound. No.
It was harder than I thought.
Loud bang. I don't know if that would startle me.
Maybe a door closing with a bang?
Oh, come on.
Finally, a winner.
I love it. Okay.
So I recorded that noise and I created an hour-long soundtrack with a bunch of bangs and then long spaces of silence in between.
I need to basically forget about it and then it comes back. And then I need to forget about it again and then it comes back, okay?
To see if my startle response would get weaker.
And, you know, whatever. If I die, I die. You watch Rocky?
I started working on something completely different, and this soundtrack was running in the background on my computer, running toward that loud bang.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, my God. Whew, I did totally forget about it.
I calmed back down and I went back to work, got immersed in something else, and...
But it was better than the first time, I thought.
And again.
I raised my arms again, startling. But my heart rate is not going up as much.
And this just kept going on and on and on.
Just as bad.
This wasn't going to get me anywhere, so I decided to try something different, just reaching a greater state of calm.
There's this Dutch guy, Wim Hof, and, you know, he goes out there, he sits in the snow, in his underwear, that kind of stuff.
Cold is merciless, righteous. It brings you direct in the depth of yourself.
He's known as the Iceman, and he has a very specific breathing technique that helps calm you down.
Breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. Just go with the flow of the breath.
I've been doing that every day, and it's helped. I'm less likely to startle at the smallest little thing.
In, out, in.
Not that this is ever going to be a concern for me, but Seth Norholm says it's good to keep in mind that your startle response serves an important purpose.
So you don't want to get to the point where you're not responding to sudden stimuli.
That's Seth Norholm. He is an associate professor of psychiatry at Wayne State University School of Medicine in Detroit. He also directs a neuroscience center for anxiety, stress, and trauma.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about anxiety and how it impacts our emotions, our behaviors, and what we can do about it. Years ago, Brian Mangini and his buddy were watching the movie Tombstone. Val Kilmer played the famous dentist, gunman, and gambler who suffered from tuberculosis.
In the movie, one of the cowboys references Doc Holliday as a lunger because he's got tuberculosis.
All right, lunger. You go to hell.
And Brian's friend started to make a joke.
My friend always used to call me a lunger because I was always coughing.
Brian doesn't remember when the cough started or where it came from, but he realized his friend was right. He was always coughing all day long.
usually a dry kind of like.
And his buddy's joke got Brian worried.
Was it tuberculosis or, you know, something serious? Because it didn't seem to be like a cold because it was just constant. So I went to my primary care at the time. He did the TB test, and that all came back clear.
He went to see an ear, nose, and throat specialist.
And at the end of the appointment, he basically told me I just needed to, like, meditate or do yoga, you know, something to calm myself.
That was not what Brian had expected at all. He was looking for some kind of physical cause that made him cough. But this kind of thing is really common. Patients come to doctors with inexplicable symptoms. It often leads to a bit of a chase, going from one specialist to the next, test after test. Regular Pulse contributor Netta Freja is a primary care physician, and she looked into what's happening with patients who have symptoms in search of a cause.
When we can't get to the bottom of what is going on with a patient, why they are having pain or other symptoms, it can feel frustrating. We've done every test imaginable. They've all come back normal. By all the numbers and measures, this person is healthy, but they are just not feeling well. This is really hard, mostly for my patient, but if I'm honest, also for me. I want to help, and it feels disappointing not to know how. When a person has an unexplainable symptom that becomes the focus of all their attention and affects their daily functioning, it's called somatic symptom disorder, or somatization.
I think of somatization as the physical manifestation of emotional or psychological or mental distress.
That's Melissa Shepherd. She's a psychiatrist, and she says, for starters, it's really important that these symptoms are not in a patient's head. They are real. Real pain, real cough, real upset stomach, but we can't find a physical cause for them. Melissa explains that there are several ways in which this can show up. For example, the person is in emotional distress that they're not addressing.
If someone's not able to express the mental or psychological stress that they're experiencing because of societal stigma, or maybe they're just not able to find the words to express it, which we call alexithymia, then sometimes it can come out as physical symptoms. It's almost your brain's way of saying, hey, you haven't been listening, so I've got to get your attention somehow.
I think we all have felt a little bit of that, maybe when our stomach started acting up during a period of high stress, or we got a raging headache before an important test. Melissa says another form of somatization is when a person is very sensitive or has a lot of anxiety and is very much tuned in to every aspect of their body.
A lot of the symptoms that people with somatic symptom disorder experience are actually normal bodily sensations, but they experience them to a greater degree and are more sensitive to picking those stimuli up.
Oh, that's fascinating. So if I experience a little bit of indigestion after a particularly heavy meal, then someone with somatic symptom disorder might take those exact symptoms but actually feel them more intensely and worry about them more.
Exactly. So it might be something that doesn't bother you at all, and you just kind of know it's a normal part of being human. But in these patients, their anxiety level and their level of concern about these physical symptoms can be so high that even something normal becomes scary.
As a physician, I have to figure out what is actually going on with the patient and rule out any serious medical issues. But there's a delicate balance to strike.
We want to protect these patients from potentially undergoing diagnostic studies and even surgeries or treatments that aren't going to be beneficial for them.
And to make matters just a little more complicated, a person can have both somatic symptom disorder and true medical disease as well. It doesn't have to be one or the other.
Say you have a patient with COPD who is doing pretty well, really only needs their oxygen at night. They're constantly thinking about their breathing and how deep their breaths are. They're monitoring their pulse ox multiple times a day. They're using oxygen when it's not necessarily appropriate to do so. So that would be an example of someone who has a diagnosable medical condition, but also a somatic symptom disorder related to the same symptoms.
Melissa's explanation helps me understand these patients a bit better. To be honest, they can make me and my colleagues a little nervous sometimes. My friend Paul Simmons is a family medicine doctor in Colorado, And when he was starting out, he took care of a patient with somatic symptom disorder. She had lots of different concerns, and Paul ordered every test he could think of to try to figure out what was going on with her. Nothing was working, and he felt like a failure.
I just kind of got this sense of despair, and every time I saw she was on my schedule, which was pretty often, my heart would kind of sink, because I was like, I am failing this lady. I am not finding what's wrong with her. And, you know, as a physician, that kind of attacks kind of the essence of your professional identity. A big chunk of our job is diagnosing what's wrong with people. And if you can't even do that, then what are we doing?
I have felt that anxiety. And sometimes it's hard not to feel a little frustrated in these situations. I asked Melissa about this.
Anytime a patient is taking up a lot of your energy and time, it can be a recipe for burnout and frustration with that person.
Melissa told me about a few ways to help patients with somatic symptom disorder. Treat their individual symptoms to help them feel better, help them cope with their symptoms so that they can still lead a good life, suggest therapy to help heal the psychological stress causing the symptoms in the first place, but most importantly, listen.
These patients are often patients who have been sort of brushed aside in the medical system or have felt disrespected in some way. These symptoms are not manufactured. These are symptoms that the person is really experiencing. And empathizing with that, with the suffering that it's causing them, can really get you pretty far in treating these patients.
Melissa also said sometimes it works to stay ahead of the patient's anxiety.
What you want to do is set regularly scheduled appointment times, maybe every 2 weeks to every month. It decreases the healthcare utilization by that patient, because if I'm thinking, oh, my stomach's really bothering me again, I might go into the ER and have it checked out tonight, but I know that I have a primary care appointment with the doctor that I trust and have been with for years the next day, I'm probably going to hold off and go to that primary care appointment. That's also going to save me from more diagnostic tests and more workup and treatments that ultimately may not work.
It turns out this exact approach worked really well for Paul Simmons, the family medicine doctor whose patient was having a lot of unexplained symptoms.
I totally switched my strategy with her. I started scheduling her weekly appointments. I wasn't going to wait for her to make the appointment. I said, why don't we have you come back every week? And then I really minimized tests. She would come in with new complaints. I would listen. I would empathize. And lo and behold, it worked. After a few weeks, she started canceling her visits with me because she didn't think they were as necessary. She would still come in every couple or 3 weeks, but she wasn't coming in every week because she felt like that was excessive and she didn't need to see me that often. It was just amazing how kind of recognizing somatization and giving that opportunity to listen was kind of a healing thing in itself to her. She actually was one of my favorite patients by the time I left that practice, and I think about her still today.
That story was reported by Netta Freja. She is a primary care physician in Maryland and host of the Primary Care Reviews and Perspectives podcast for Hippo Education. As for Brian Mangini, who has an unexplained cough, he says he's totally come to terms with it.
You know, it's after 20 or so years of dealing with this, it's, you know, it's as much a part of me as breathing.
We're talking about anxiety and how it rears its head in unexpected ways. Many of us think of our smartphones as a safety blanket. Anybody can reach us, and we can reach anybody immediately. Help in case of emergency, directions, a burrito, it's all just a click away. But phones and the expectation of instant communication can also contribute to lots of anxious feelings. Think about how communication used to work, even 15 or 20 years ago, when we still wrote letters or called each other on our landlines. Anthropologist Patty Kelly was living in Mexico in the mid-90s, and she had arranged to visit her uncle, who lived in a town called Palenque. It was about a six-hour trip by bus. They had decided the date via letter because her uncle didn't have a phone. And so on the day in question, Patty set out to get on her way.
I go to the bus station to get a ticket, and they tell me that there are, I think it was campesinos, maybe teachers, blocking the highway, and so there would be no bus that day.
Protesters, making it impossible to get past on narrow mountain roads.
Probably the prices of corn, the free trade agreement, the teachers' union striking. It's a very effective way of getting attention from the government, so more power to them.
So she goes back to the bus stop the next day.
Nope, no buses.
7 days go by until she's finally able to catch the bus.
And then when I finally arrived, I was a week late. I mean, that's substantially late. And we were both completely nonplussed, you know. He said, oh, good, you made it. And I said, yeah, I made it. And that was it.
Neither she nor her uncle felt any anxiety about this at all.
That is the miraculous thing. This seems so strange to me. No, there was no stress.
Try to imagine this now. You have scheduled a visit with a family member. They don't show up, and then you don't hear from them at all for an entire week. You would call the police, right? Or all the hospitals.
When the phone doesn't work, then you just assume that something happened.
That's Monica Rogozinski. Her son is a teenager. He's a busy kid. School, soccer, friends. And she says he often doesn't answer when she's trying to reach him.
Every second something could have happened and anxiety builds up. It's an uncomfortable distraction because it's this false sensation that you have access to information and control of a situation that you don't. You know, because the phone is there, you keep checking and you think that the phone will be responding to your anxiety to get information.
Psychologist Simone Gorko first realized how much our mindset had shifted when she volunteered as a counselor for the Red Cross. She was supporting families who had loved ones in the military deployed in Afghanistan. They were worried, understandably, but the anxiety was made far worse because they couldn't talk to them all the time.
Why can't I reach him? I need to know how he is. I had to explain to them that they were in a war zone, that they were busy, and that they couldn't communicate. There couldn't be that instant communication that they were used to.
Simone says these days, many people's minds tend to race to the worst-case scenario, an accident, a heart attack, a murder. So the first step is to think of some more likely and benign alternatives.
Well, maybe they're in a meeting. Maybe they don't have their cell phone with them. Maybe they're in class. Maybe this, maybe that. And say, well, that's likely.
Then take a deep breath.
We do something called square breathing, where you breathe in for 5 seconds, you hold it for 5 seconds, you breathe out for 5 seconds. And if you do that 3 times, you can calm yourself down.
And finally, you can postpone the anxiety.
Okay, I'm not going to worry right now. If I don't hear back in an hour, then I'll get worried.
Monica Rogozinski says she tries to do all of those things, but still, when her son is out with his friends and he doesn't get back to her, she usually calls around until she gets a hold of one of the other parents.
Someone will have to reach those kids at some point and get like, oh, we were having milkshake at Shake Shack type of reply.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Hannah Fulmer is our intern. Sojourner Ahebe is our health equity fellow. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, and we had engineering help this week from Mike Villers. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Overexposure. Let's talk it over. Let's go out and paint the